Chapter 17. Early next day, Ransom again took his seat on Augrey's shoulder. For more than an hour they travelled through the same bright wilderness. Far to the north the sky was luminous, with a cloud-like mass of dull red or ochre. It was very large, and drove furiously westward about 10 miles above the waste. Ransom, who had yet seen no cloud in the Malacandrian sky, asked what it was. The Sorn told him it was sand caught up from the great northern deserts by the winds of that terrible country. It was often thus carried, sometimes at a height of 17 miles, to fall again, perhaps in a handramit, as a choking and blinding dust-storm. The sight of it moving with menace in the naked sky served to remind Ransom that they were indeed on the outside of Malacandra, no longer dwelling in a world but crawling the surface of a strange planet. At last the cloud seemed to drop and burst far on the western horizon, where a glow, not unlike that of a conflagration, remained visible until a turn of the valley hid all that region from his view. The same turn opened a new prospect to his eyes. What lay before him looked at first strangely like an earthly landscape, a landscape of grey downland ridges rising and falling like waves of the sea. Far beyond, cliffs and spires of the familiar green rock rose against the dark blue sky. A moment later he saw that what he had taken for downlands was but the ridged and furrowed surface of a blue-grey valley mist, a mist which would not appear a mist at all when they descended into the Handramit. And already, as their road began descending, it was less visible, and the many-coloured pattern of the low country showed vaguely through it. The descent grew quickly steeper, like the jagged teeth of a giant with very bad teeth. The topmost peaks of the mountain wall down which they must pass loomed up over the edge of their gully. The look of the sky and the quality of the light were infinitesimally changed. A moment later they stood on the edge of such a slope as by earthly standards would rather be called a precipice. Down and down this face, to where it vanished in a purple blush of vegetation, ran their road. Ransom refused absolutely to make the descent on Augrey's shoulder. The Sorn, though it did not fully understand his objection, stooped for him to dismount, and proceeded, with that same skating and forward-sloping motion, to go down before him. Ransom followed, using gladly but stiffly his numb legs. The beauty of this new Handramit, as it opened before him, took his breath away. It was wider than that in which he had hitherto lived, and right below him lay an almost circular lake, a sapphire 12 miles in diameter, set in a border of purple forest. Amidst the lake there rose, like a low and gently sloping pyramid, or like a woman's breast, an island of pale red, smooth to the summit, and on the summit a grove of such trees as man had never seen. Their smooth columns had the gentle swell of the noblest beech trees. But these were taller than a cathedral spire on earth, and at their tops they broke rather into flower than foliage, into golden flower bright as tulip, still as rock, and huge as summer cloud. Flowers indeed they were, not trees, and far down among their roots he caught a pale hint of slab-like architecture. He knew before his guide told him that this was Meldilorn. He did not know what he had expected. The old dreams which he had brought from earth of some more than American complexity of offices, or some engineer's paradise of vast machines, had indeed been long laid aside. But he had not looked for anything quite so classic, so virginal, as this bright grove, lying so still, so secret in its coloured valley, soaring with inimitable grace so many 100 feet into the wintry sunlight. At every step of his descent the comparative warmth of the valley came up to him more deliciously. He looked above, the sky was turning to a paler blue. He looked below, and sweet and faint the thin fragrance of the giant blooms came up to him. Distant crags were growing less sharp in outline, and surfaces less bright. Depth, dimness, softness, and perspective were returning to the landscape. The lip or edge of rock from which they had started their descent was already far overhead. It seemed unlikely that they had really come from there. He was breathing freely. His toes, so long benumbed, could move delightfully inside his boots. He lifted the ear-flaps of his cap and found his ears instantly filled with the sound of falling water. And now he was treading on soft groundweed over level earth, and the forest roof was above his head. They had conquered the Harandra and were on the threshold of Meldilorn. A short walk brought them into a kind of forest ride, a broad avenue running straight as an arrow through the purple stems to where the vivid blue of the lake danced at the end of it. There they found a gong and hammer hung on a pillar of stone. These objects were all richly decorated, and the gong and hammer were of a greenish-blue metal which Ransom did not recognize. Orgray struck the gong. An excitement was rising in Ransom's mind which almost prevented him from examining, as coolly as he wished, the ornamentation of the stone. It was partly pictorial, partly pure decoration. What chiefly struck him was a certain balance of packed and empty surfaces. Pure line drawings, as bare as the prehistoric pictures of reindeer on Earth, alternated with patches of design as close and intricate as Norse or Celtic jewellery. And then, as you looked at it, these empty and crowded areas turned out to be themselves arranged in larger designs. He was struck by the fact that the pictorial work was not confined to the emptier spaces. Quite often, large arabesques included, as a subordinate detail, intricate pictures. Elsewhere, the opposite plan had been followed, and this alternation, too, had a rhythmical or patterned element to it. He was just beginning to find out that the pictures, though stylized, were obviously intended to tell a story, when Orgray interrupted him. A ship had put out from the island shore of Meldilorn. As it came towards them, Ransom's heart warmed to see that it was paddled by a hross. The creature brought its boat up to the shore where they were waiting, stared at Ransom, and then looked inquiringly at Orgray. "You may well wonder at this now, Hrynha," said the Sorn, "for you have never seen anything like it. It is called Rensum, and has come through heaven from Tholkandra." "It is welcome, Orgray," said the Hross politely. "Is it coming to Oyarsa?" "He has sent for it." "And for you also, Orgray?" "Oyarsa has not called me. If you will take Rensum over the water, I will go back to my tower." The Hross indicated that Ransom should enter the boat. He attempted to express his thanks to the Sorn, and, after a moment's consideration, unstrapped his wristwatch and offered it to him. It was the only thing he had which seemed a suitable present for a Sorn. He had no difficulty in making Orgray understand its purpose, but after examining it, the giant gave it back to him, a little reluctantly, and said, "This gift ought to be given to a Fiffletrig. It rejoices my heart, but they would make more of it. You are likely to meet some of the busy people in Meldilorn. Give it to them. As for its use, do your people not know, except by looking at this thing, how much of the day has worn?" "I believe there are beasts that have a sort of knowledge of that," said Ransom, "but our Hnau have lost it." After this, his farewells to the Sorn were made, and he embarked. To be once more in a boat, and with a Hross, to feel the warmth of water on his face and to see a blue sky above him was almost like coming home. He took off his cap and leaned back luxuriously in the bows, plying his escort with questions. He learned that the Hrossa were not specially concerned with the service of Oyarsa, as he had surmised from finding a Hross in charge of the ferry. All three species of Hnau served him in their various capacities, and the ferry was naturally entrusted to those who understood boats. He learned that his own procedure on arriving in Meldilorn must be to go where he liked and do what he pleased until Oyarsa called for him. It might be an hour or several days before this happened. He would find huts near the landing place where he could sleep if necessary, and where food would be given him. In return, he related as much as he could make intelligible of his own world and his journey from it, and he warned the Hross of the dangerous bent men who had brought him and who were still at large on Malacandra. As he did so, it occurred to him that he had not made this sufficiently clear to Orgray. But he consoled himself with the reflection that Weston and Divine seemed to have already some liaison with the Sorens, and that they would not be likely to molest things so large and so comparatively manlike. At any rate, not yet. About Divine's ultimate designs he had no illusions. All he could do was to make a clean breast of them to Oyarsa. And now the ship touched land. Ransom rose while the Hross was making fast and looked about him. Close to the little harbour which they had entered, and to the left, were low buildings of stone, the first he had seen in Malacandra, and fires were burning. There, the Hross told him, he could find food and shelter. For the rest of the island seemed desolate, and its smooth slopes empty up to the grove that crowned them, where again he saw stonework. But this appeared to be neither temple nor house in the human sense, but a broad avenue of monoliths, a much larger Stonehenge, stately, empty, and vanishing over the crest of the hill into the pale shadow of the flower trunks. All was solitude. But as he gazed upon it, he seemed to hear, against the background of morning silence, a faint, continual agitation of silvery sound, hardly a sound at all, if you attended to it, and yet impossible to ignore. "The island is all full of Eldila," said the Hross, in a hushed voice. He went ashore. As though half expecting some obstacle, he took a few hesitant paces forward and stopped, and then went on again in the same fashion. Though the groundweed was unusually soft and rich, and his feet made no noise upon it, he felt an impulse to walk on tiptoes. All his movements became gentle and sedate. The width of the water about this island made the air warmer than any he had yet breathed in Malacandra. The climate was almost that of a warm, earthly day in late September, a day that is warm but with a hint of frost to come. The sense of awe which was increasing upon him deterred him from approaching the crown of the hill, the grove, and the avenue of standing stones. He ceased ascending about halfway up the hill and began walking to his right, keeping a constant distance from the shore. He said to himself that he was having a look at the island, but his feeling was rather that the island was having a look at him. This was greatly increased by a discovery he made after he had been walking for about an hour, and which he ever afterwards found great difficulty in describing. In the most abstract terms, it might be summed up by saying that the surface of the island was subject to tiny variations of light and shade, which no change in the sky accounted for. If the air had not been calm, and the groundweed too short and firm to move in the wind, he would have said that a faint breeze was playing with it, and working such slight alterations in the shading as it does in a cornfield on the earth. Like the silvery noises in the air, these footsteps of light were shy of observation. Where he looked hardest, they were least to be seen. On the edges of his field of vision they came crowding, as though a complex arrangement of them were there in progress. To attend to any one of them was to make it invisible, and the minute brightness seemed often to have just left the spot where his eyes fell. He had no doubt that he was seeing, as much as he ever would see, the Eldila. The sensation it produced in him was curious. It was not exactly uncanny, not as if he were surrounded by ghosts. It was not even as if he were being spied upon. He had rather the sense of being looked at by things that had a right to look. His feeling was less than fear. It had in it something of embarrassment, something of shyness, something of submission, and it was profoundly uneasy. He felt tired, and thought that in this favoured land it would be warm enough to rest out of doors. He sat down. The softness of the weed, the warmth, and the sweet smell which pervaded the whole island reminded him of earth and gardens in summer. He closed his eyes for a moment, then he opened them again and noticed buildings below him, and over the lake he saw a boat approaching. Recognition suddenly came to him. That was the ferry, and these buildings were the guest house beside the harbour. He had walked all round the island. A certain disappointment succeeded this discovery. He was beginning to feel hungry. Perhaps it would be a good plan to go down and ask for some food. At any rate, it would pass the time. But he did not do so. When he rose and looked more closely at the guest house, he saw a considerable stir of creatures about it, and while he watched, he saw that a full load of passengers was landing from the ferryboat. In the lake, he saw some moving objects which he did not at first identify, but which turned out to be sorns, up to their middles in the water, and obviously wading to Meldilorn from the mainland. There were about 10 of them. For some reason or other, the island was receiving an influx of visitors. He no longer supposed that any harm would be done to him if he went down and mixed in the crowd, but he felt a reluctance to do so. The situation brought vividly back to his mind his experience as a new boy at school. New boys came a day early, hanging about and watching the arrival of the old hands. In the end, he decided not to go down. He cut and ate some of the groundweed and dozed for a little. In the afternoon, when it grew colder, he resumed his walking. Other now were roaming about the island by this time. He saw sorns chiefly, but this was because their height made them conspicuous. There was hardly any noise. His reluctance to meet these fellow wanderers, who seemed to confine themselves to the coast of the island, drove him half-consciously upwards and inwards. He found himself at last on the fringes of the grove, and looking straight up the monolithic avenue.
He had intended, for no very clearly defined reason, not to enter it, but he fell to studying the stone nearest to him, which was richly sculptured on all its four sides, and after that curiosity led him on from stone to stone. The pictures were very puzzling. Side by side with representations of Sorns and Hrossa, and what he supposed to be Fiffeltriggy, there occurred again and again an upright wavy figure with only the suggestion of a face, and with wings. The wings were perfectly recognizable, and this puzzled him very much. Could it be that the traditions of Malachandrian art went back to that earlier geological and biological era when, as Aughrey had told him, there was life, including bird life, on the Harandra? The answer of the stones seemed to be yes. He saw pictures of the old red forests with unmistakable birds flying among them, and many other creatures that he did not know. On another stone, many of these were represented lying dead, and a fantastic Hnakra-like figure, presumably symbolizing the cold, was depicted in the sky above them, shooting at them with darts. Creatures still alive were crowding round the winged, wavy figure, which he took to be Oyarsa, pictured as a winged flame. On the next stone, Oyarsa appeared, followed by many creatures, and apparently making a furrow with some pointed instrument. Another picture showed the furrow being enlarged by Fiffeltriggy with digging tools. Sorns were piling the earth up in pinnacles on each side, and Hrossa seemed to be making water channels. Ransom wondered whether this were a mythical account of the making of Handramits, or whether they were conceivably artificial in fact. Many of the pictures he could make nothing of. One that particularly puzzled him showed at the bottom a segment of a circle, behind and above which rose three quarters of a disk divided into concentric rings. He thought it was a picture of the sun rising behind a hill. Certainly the segment at the bottom was full of Malachandrian scenes, Oyarsa in Meldilorn, Sorens on the mountain edge of the Harandra, and many other things both familiar to him and strange. He turned from it to examine the disk which rose behind it. It was not the sun. The sun was there, unmistakably, at the centre of the disk. Round this the concentric circles revolved. In the first and smallest of these was pictured a little ball, on which rode a winged figure, something like Oyarsa, but holding what appeared to be a trumpet. In the next, a similar ball carried another of the flaming figures. This one, instead of even the suggested face, had two bulges, which, after long inspection, he decided were meant to be the udders or breasts of a female mammal. By this time he was quite sure that he was looking at a picture of the solar system. The first ball was Mercury, the second Venus. And what an extraordinary coincidence, thought Ransom, that their mythology, like ours, associates some idea of the female with Venus. The problem would have occupied him longer if a natural curiosity had not drawn his eyes on to the next ball, which must represent the Earth. When he saw it, his whole mind stood still for a moment. The ball was there. But where the flame-like figure should have been, a deep depression of irregular shape had been cut, as if to erase it. Once then, but his speculations faltered and became silent before a series of unknowns. He looked at the next circle. Here there was no ball. Instead, the bottom of this circle touched the top of the big segment filled with Malachandrian scenes, so that Malachandra at this point touched the solar system and came out of it in perspective towards the spectator. Now that his mind had grasped the design, he was astonished at the vividness of it all. He stood back and drew a deep breath, preparatory to tackling some of the mysteries in which he was engulfed. Malachandra, then, was Mars. The Earth... But at this point a sound of tapping or hammering, which had been going on for some time without gaining admission to his consciousness, became too insistent to be ignored. Some creature, and certainly not an Eldil, was at work, close to him. A little startled, for he had been deep in thought, he turned round. There was nothing to be seen. He shouted out, idiotically, in English, "Who's there?" The tapping instantly stopped, and a remarkable face appeared from behind a neighbouring monolith. It was hairless, like a man's or a Sorn's. It was long and pointed like a shrew's, yellow and shabby-looking, and so low in the forehead that but for the heavy development of the head at the back and behind the ears, like a bag wig, it could not have been that of an intelligent creature. A moment later the whole of the thing came into view with a startling jump. Ransom guessed that it was a Fiffeltrigg, and was glad that he had not met one of this third race on his first arrival in Malacandra. It was much more insect-like or reptilian than anything he had yet seen. Its build was distinctly that of a frog, and at first Ransom thought it was resting, frog-like, on its hands. Then he noticed that that part of its forelimbs on which it was supported was really, in human terms, rather an elbow than a hand. It was broad and padded, and clearly made to be walked on. But upwards from it, at an angle of about 45 degrees, went the true forearms, thin, strong forearms, ending in enormous, sensitive, many-fingered hands. He realized that for all manual work, from mining to cutting cameos, this creature had the advantage of being able to work with its full strength from a supported elbow. The insect-like effect was due to the speed and jerkiness of its movements, and to the fact that it could swivel its head almost all the way round, like a mantis. And it was increased by a kind of dry, rasping, jingling quality in the noise of its moving. It was rather like a grasshopper, rather like one of Arthur Rackham's dwarfs, rather like a frog, and rather like a little old taxidermist whom Ransom knew in London. "I come from another world," began Ransom. "I know, I know," said the creature, in a quick, twittering, rather impatient voice. "Come here, behind the stone. This way, this way. Oyasa's orders. Very busy. Must begin at once. Stand there." Ransom found himself on the other side of the monolith, staring at a picture which was still in process of completion. The ground was liberally strewn with chips, and the air was full of dust. "There," said the creature. "Stand still. Don't look at me. Look over there." For a moment, Ransom did not quite understand what was expected of him. Then, as he saw the Fiffletrig glancing to and fro at him and at the stone, with the unmistakable glance of artist from model to work, which is the same in all worlds, he realized and almost laughed. He was standing for his portrait. From his position he could see that the creature was cutting the stone as if it were cheese, and the swiftness of its movements almost baffled his eyes, but he could get no impression of the work done, though he could study the Fiffletrig. He saw that the jingling and metallic noise was due to the number of small instruments which it carried about its body. Sometimes, with an exclamation of annoyance, it would throw down the tool it was working with and select one of these, but the majority of those in immediate use it kept in its mouth. He realized also that this was an animal artificially clothed, like himself, in some bright scaly substance which appeared richly decorated, though coated in dust. It had folds of furry clothing about its throat, like a comforter, and its eyes were protected by dark, bulging goggles. Rings and chains of a bright metal, not gold, he thought, adorned its limbs and neck. All the time it was working it kept up a sort of hissing whisper to itself, and when it was excited, which it usually was, the end of its nose wrinkled like a rabbit's. At last it gave another startling leap, landed 10 yards away from its work, and said, "Yes, yes, not so good as I hoped. Do better another time. Leave it now. Come and see yourself." Ransom obeyed. He saw a picture of the planets, not now arranged to make a map of the solar system, but advancing in a single procession towards the spectator, and all, save one, bearing its fiery charioteer. Below lay Malacandra, and there, to his surprise, was a very tolerable picture of the spaceship. Beside it stood three figures, for all of which Ransom had apparently been the model. He recoiled from them in disgust. Even allowing for the strangeness of the subject from a Malacandrian point of view, and for the stylization of their art, still, he thought, the creature might have made a better attempt at the human form than these stock-like dummies, almost as thick as they were tall, and sprouting about the head and neck into something that looked like fungus. He hedged. "I expect it is like me as I look to your people," he said. "It is not how they would draw me in my own world." "No," said the Fiffletrig. "I do not mean it to be too like. Too like, and they will not believe it, those who are born after." He added a good deal more, which was difficult to understand, but while he was speaking it dawned upon Ransom that the odious figures were intended as an idealization of humanity. Conversation languished for a little. To change the subject, Ransom asked a question which had been in his mind for some time. "I cannot understand," he said, "how you and the Saurons and the Hrossa all come to speak the same speech, for your tongues and teeth and throats must be very different." "You are right," said the creature. "Once we all had different speeches, and we still have at home. But everyone has learned the speech of the Hrossa." "Well, why is that?" said Ransom, still thinking in terms of terrestrial history. "Did the Hrossa once rule the others?" I do not understand. They are our great speakers and singers. They have more words and better. No one learns the speech of my people, for what we have to say is said in stone and sun's blood and star's milk, and all can see them. No one learns the sworn speech, for you can change their knowledge into any words, and it is still the same. You cannot do that with the songs of the Hrossa. Their tongue goes all over Malakandra. I speak it to you because you are a stranger. I would speak it to a sworn. But we have our old tongues at home. You can see it in the names. The Saurons have big-sounding names like Ogre and Arkal and Belmo and Falme. The Hrossa have furry names like No and Nihi and Hjoi and Hlithnahi. The best poetry, then, comes in the roughest speech? Perhaps, said the Fiffletrig, as the best pictures are made in the hardest stone. But my people have names like Kalakaperi, Barakataru, and Tafalakerov. I am called Kanakaberaka. Ransom told it his name. In our country, said Kanakaberaka, it is not like this. We are not pinched in a narrow handramit. There are the true forests, the green shadows, the deep mines. It is warm. It does not blaze with light like this, and it is not silent like this. I could put you in a place there in the forests where you could see 100 fires at once and hear 100 hammers. I wish you had come to our country. We do not live in holes like the Saurons, nor in bundles of weed like the Hrossa. I could show you houses with 100 pillars, one sun's blood and the next of star's milk, all the way, and all the world painted on the walls. How do you rule yourselves? Asked Ransom. Those who are digging in the mines, do they like it as much as those who paint the walls? All keep the mines open. It is a work to be shared. But each digs for himself the thing he wants for his work. What else would he do? It is not so with us. Then you must make very bent work. How would a maker understand working in sun's blood unless he went into the home of sun's blood himself and knew one kind from another, and lived with it for days out of the light of the sky till it was in his blood and his heart, as if he thought it and ate it and spat it? With us it lies very deep and hard to get, and those who dig it must spend their whole lives on the skill. And they love it? I think not. I do not know. They are kept at it because they are given no food if they stop. Kanakaberaka wrinkled his nose. Then there is not food in plenty on your world? I do not know, said Ransom. I have often wished to know the answer to that question, but no one can tell me. Does no one keep your people at their work, Kanakaberaka? Our females, said the Fiffletrig, with a piping noise which was apparently his equivalent for a laugh. Are your females of more account among you than those of the other now among them? Very greatly. The Saurons make least account of females, and we make most. Chapter 18. That night Ransom slept in the guest house, which was a real house built by Fiffletriggy and richly decorated. His pleasure at finding himself, in this respect, under more human conditions, was qualified by the discomfort which, despite his reason, he could not help feeling in the presence, at close quarters, of so many Malakandrian creatures. All three species were represented. They seemed to have no uneasy feelings towards each other, though there were some differences of the kind that occur in a railway carriage on Earth, the Saurons finding the house too hot, and the Fiffletriggy finding it too cold. He learned more of Malakandrian humour and of the noises that expressed it in this one night than he had learned during the whole of his life on the strange planet hitherto. Indeed, nearly all Malakandrian conversations in which he had yet taken part had been grave. Apparently, the comic spirit arose chiefly from the meeting of the different kinds of Hnau. The jokes of all three were equally incomprehensible to him. He thought he could see differences in kind, as that the Saurons seldom got beyond irony, while the Hrossa were extravagant and fantastic, and the Fiffletriggy were sharp and excelled in abuse. But even when he understood all the words, he could not see the points. He went early to bed. It was at the time of early morning, when men on earth go out to milk the cows, that Ransom was awakened. At first he did not know what had roused him. The chamber in which he lay was silent, empty, and nearly dark. He was preparing himself to sleep again when a high-pitched voice close beside him said, "Oyarsa sends for you." He sat up, staring about him. There was no one there, and the voice repeated, "Oyarsa sends for you." The confusion of sleep was now clearing in his head, and he recognized that there was an Eldil in the room. He felt no conscious fear, but while he rose obediently and put on such of his clothes as he had laid aside, he found that his heart was beating rather fast. He was thinking less of the invisible creature in the room than of the interview that lay before him. His old terrors of meeting some monster or idol had quite left him. He felt nervous, as he remembered feeling on the morning of an examination when he was an undergraduate. More than anything in the world, he would have liked a cup of good tea. The guest house was empty. He went out. The bluish smoke was rising from the lake, and the sky was bright behind the jagged eastern wall of the canyon. It was a few minutes before sunrise. The air was still very cold, the ground weed drenched with dew, and there was something puzzling about the whole scene which he presently identified with the silence. The Eldil voices in the air had ceased, and so had the shifting network of small lights and shades. Without being told, he knew that it was his business to go up to the crown of the island and the grove. As he approached them, he saw with a certain sinking of heart that the monolithic avenue was full of Malachandrian creatures, and all silent. They were in two lines, one on each side, and all squatting or sitting in the various fashions suitable to their anatomies. He walked on, slowly and doubtfully, not daring to stop, and ran the gauntlet of all those inhuman and unblinking eyes. When he had come to the very summit, at the middle of the avenue where the biggest of the stones rose, he stopped. He never could remember afterwards whether an Eldil voice had told him to do so, or whether it was an intuition of his own. He did not sit down, for the earth was too cold and wet, and he was not sure if it would be decorous. He simply stood, motionless, like a man on parade. All the creatures were looking at him, and there was no noise anywhere. He perceived, gradually, that the place was full of Eldila. The lights, or suggestions of light, which yesterday had been scattered over the island, were now all congregated in this one spot, and were all stationary, or very faintly moving. The sun had risen by now, and still no one spoke. As he looked up to see the first pale sunlight upon the monoliths, he became conscious that the air above him was full of a far greater complexity of light than the sunrise could explain, and light of a different kind, Eldil light. The sky, no less than the earth, was full of them. The visible Malachandrians were but the smallest part of the silent consistory which surrounded him. He might, when the time came, be pleading his cause before thousands, or before millions, rank behind rank about him, and rank above rank over his head. The creatures that had never yet seen man, and whom man could not see, were waiting for his trial to begin. He licked his lips, which were quite dry, and wondered if he would be able to speak when speech was demanded of him. Then it occurred to him that perhaps this waiting and being looked at, was the trial. Perhaps even now he was unconsciously telling them all they wished to know. But afterwards, a long time afterwards, there was a noise of movement. Every visible creature in the grove had risen to its feet and was standing, more hushed than ever, with its head bowed. And Ransom saw, if it could be called seeing, that Oyarsa was coming up between the long lines of sculptured stones. Partly he knew it from the faces of the Malachandrians as their lord passed them. Partly he saw, he could not deny that he saw, Oyarsa himself. He never could say what it was like. The merest whisper of light, no, less than that, the smallest diminution of shadow, was travelling along the uneven surface of the groundweed. Or rather, some difference in the look of the ground, too slight to be named in the language of the five senses, moved slowly towards him. Like a silence spreading over a room full of people, like an infinitesimal coolness on a sultry day, like a passing memory of some long-forgotten sound or scent, like all that is stillest and smallest and most hard to seize in nature, Oyarsa passed between his subjects and drew near and came to rest not 10 yards away from Ransom in the centre of Meldilorn. Ransom felt a tingling of his blood and a pricking on his fingers as if lightning were near him, and his heart and body seemed to him to be made of water. Oyarsa spoke, a more unhuman voice than Ransom had yet heard, sweet and seemingly remote, an unshaken voice, a voice, as one of the Hrossa afterwards said to Ransom, with no blood in it. Light is instead of blood for them. The words were not alarming. "What are you so afraid of, Ransom of Tholkandra?" it said. "Of you, Oyarsa, because you are unlike me, and I cannot see you." "Those are not great reasons," said the voice. "You are also unlike me,
and though I see you very faintly. But do not think we are utterly unlike. We are both copies of Maleldil. These are not the real reasons." Ransom said nothing. "You began to be afraid of me before you set foot in my world, and you have spent all your time then in flying from me. My servants saw your fear when you were in your ship in heaven. They saw that your own kind treated you ill, though they could not understand their speech. Then, to deliver you out of the hands of those two, I stirred up Ahnakra to try if you would come to me of your own will. But you hid among the Hrossa, and though they told you to come to me, you would not. After that, I sent my Eldil to fetch you, but still you would not come. And in the end, your own kind have chased you to me, and Hnau's blood has been shed." "I do not understand, O Yarsa. Do you mean that it was you who sent for me from Tholkandra?" "Yes. Did not the other two tell you this? And why did you come with them, unless you meant to obey my call? My servants could not understand their talk to you when your ship was in heaven." "Your servants, I cannot understand," said Ransom. "Ask freely," said the voice. "Have you servants out in the heavens?" "Where else? There is nowhere else." "But you, O Yarsa, are here on Malakandra, as I am." "But Malakandra, like all worlds, floats in heaven. And I am not here altogether as you are, Ransom of Tholkandra. Creatures of your kind must drop out of the heavens into a world. For us, the worlds are places in heaven. But do not try to understand this now. It is enough to know that I and my servants are even now in heaven. They were around you in the skyship no less than they are around you here." "Then you knew of our journey before we left Tholkandra?" "No. Tholkandra is the world we do not know. It alone is outside the heaven, and no message comes from it." Ransom was silent, but Oyarsa answered his unspoken questions. "It was not always so. Once we knew the Oyarsa of your world, he was brighter and greater than I, and then we did not call it Tholkandra. It is the longest of all stories and the bitterest. He became bent. That was before any life came on your world. Those were the bent years of which we still speak in the heavens, when he was not yet bound to Tholkandra, but free like us. It was in his mind to spoil other worlds beside his own. He smote your moon with his left hand, and with his right he brought the cold death on Maharandra before its time. If by my arm Maleldil had not opened the Handramits and let out the hot springs, my world would have been unpeopled. We did not leave him so at large for long. There was great war, and we drove him back out of the heavens and bound him in the air of his own world, as Maleldil taught us. There doubtless he lies to this hour, and we know no more of that planet. It is silent. We think that Maleldil would not give it up utterly to the Bent One, and there are stories among us that he has taken strange counsel and dared terrible things, wrestling with the Bent One in Tholkandra. But of this we know less than you. It is a thing we desire to look into." It was some time before Ransom spoke again, and Oyarsa respected his silence. When he had collected himself, he said, "After this story, Oyarsa, I may tell you that our world is very bent. The two who brought me here knew nothing of you, but only that the Sorns had asked for me. They thought you were a false Eldil, I think. There are false Eldila in the wild parts of our world. Men kill other men before them. They think the Eldil drinks blood. They thought the Sorns wanted me for this or for some other evil. They brought me by force. I was in terrible fear. The tellers of tales in our world make us think that if there is any life beyond our own air, it is evil." "I understand," said the voice, "and this explains things that I have wondered at. As soon as your journey had passed your own air and entered heaven, my servants told me that you seemed to be coming unwillingly, and that the others had secrets from you. I did not think any creature could be so bent as to bring another of its own kind here by force. They did not know what you wanted me for, Oyarsa, nor do I know yet. I will tell you. 2 years ago, and that is about 4 of your years, this ship entered the heavens from your world. We followed its journey all the way hither, and Eldila were with it as it sailed over the Harandra, and when at last it came to rest in the Handramit, more than half my servants were standing round it to see the strangers come out. All beasts we kept back from the place, and no Hnau yet knew of it. When the strangers had walked to and fro on Malacandra and made themselves a hut, and their fear of a new world ought to have worn off, I sent certain Saurns to show themselves and to teach the strangers our language. I chose Saurns because they are most like your people in form. The Tholkandrians feared the Saurns and were very unteachable. The Saurns went to them many times and taught them a little. They reported to me that the Tholkandrians were taking sun's blood wherever they could find it in the streams. When I could make nothing of them by report, I told the Saurns to bring them to me, not by force, but courteously. They would not come. I asked for one of them, but not even one of them would come. It would have been easy to take them, but though we saw they were stupid, we did not yet know how bent they were, and I did not wish to stretch my authority beyond the creatures of my own world. I told the Saurns to treat them like cubs, to tell them that they would be allowed to pick up no more of the sun's blood until one of their race came to me. When they were told this, they stuffed as much as they could into the skyship and went back to their own world. We wondered at this, but now it is plain. They thought I wanted one of your race to eat, and went to fetch one. If they had come a few miles to see me, I would have received them honorably. Now they have twice gone a voyage of millions of miles for nothing, and will appear before me none the less. And you also, Ransom of Tholkandra, you have taken many vain troubles to avoid standing where you stand now. That is true, O Yarsa. Bent creatures are full of fears. But I am here now, and ready to know your will with me. Two things I wanted to ask of your race. First, I must know why you come here. So much is my duty to my world. And secondly, I wish to hear of Tholkandra, and of Maleldil's strange wars there with the Bent One. For that, as I have said, is a thing we desire to look into. For the first question, O Yarsa, I have come here because I was brought. Of the others, one cares for nothing but the sun's blood, because in our world he can exchange it for many pleasures and powers. But the other means evil to you. I think he would destroy all your people to make room for our people, and then he would do the same with other worlds again. He wants our race to last for always, I think, and he hopes they will leap from world to world, always going to a new sun when an old one dies, or something like that. Is he wounded in his brain? I do not know. Perhaps I do not describe his thoughts right. He is more learned than I. Does he think he could go to the great worlds? Does he think Maleldil wants a race to live forever? He does not know there is any Maleldil. But what is certain, O Yarsa, is that he means evil to your world. Our kind must not be allowed to come here again. If you can prevent it only by killing all three of us, I am content. If you were my own people, I would kill them now, Ransom, and you soon. For they are bent beyond hope. And you, when you have grown a little braver, will be ready to go to Maleldil. But my authority is over my own world. It is a terrible thing to kill someone else's now. It will not be necessary. Well, they are strong, O Yarsa, and they can throw death many miles, and can blow killing airs at their enemies. The least of my servants could touch their ship before it reached Malacandra, while it was in the heaven, and make it a body of different movements, or you, no body at all. Be sure that no one of your race will come into my world again unless I call him. But enough of this. Now tell me of Tholkandra. Tell me all. We know nothing since the day when the Bent One sank out of heaven into the air of your world, wounded in the very light of his light. But why have you become afraid again? I am afraid of the lengths of time, O Yarsa, or perhaps I do not understand. Did you not say this happened before there was life on Tholkandra? Yes. And you, O Yarsa, you have lived. And that picture on the stone where the cold is killing them on the Harandra, is that a picture of something that was before my world began? I see you are now, after all, said the voice. Doubtless no stone that faced the air then would be a stone now. The picture has begun to crumble away and been copied again more times than there are Eldila in the air above us. But it was copied right. In that way you are seeing a picture that was finished when your world was still half-made. But do not think of these things. My people have a law never to speak much of sizes or numbers to you others, not even to Saurns. You do not understand, and it makes you do reverence to nothings, and pass by what is really great. Rather tell me what Maleldil has done in Tholkandra. According to our traditions, Ransom was beginning when an unexpected disturbance broke in upon the solemn stillness of the assembly. A large party, almost a procession, was approaching the grove from the direction of the ferry. It consisted entirely, as far as he could see, of Hrossa, and they appeared to be carrying something.
Chapter 19. As the procession drew nearer, Ransom saw that the foremost Hrossa were supporting three long and narrow burdens. They carried them on their heads, four Hrossa to each. After these came a number of others armed with harpoons, and apparently guarding two creatures which he did not recognize. The light was behind them as they entered between the two farthest monoliths. They were much shorter than any animal he had yet seen on Malacandra, and he gathered that they were bipeds, though the lower limbs were so thick and sausage-like that he hesitated to call them legs. The bodies were a little narrower at the top than at the bottom, so as to be very slightly pear-shaped, and the heads were neither round, like those of Hrossa, nor long, like those of Saurns, but almost square. They stumped along on narrow, heavy-looking feet, which they seemed to press into the ground with unnecessary violence. And now their faces were becoming visible as masses of lumped and puckered flesh of variegated colour, fringed in some bristly, dark substance. Suddenly, with an indescribable change of feeling, he realized that he was looking at men. The two prisoners were Western and Divine, and he, for one privileged moment, had seen the human form with almost Malacandrian eyes. The leaders of the procession had now advanced to within a few yards of Oyarsa and laid down their burdens. These, he now saw, were three dead Hrossa laid on biers of some unknown metal. They were on their backs, and their eyes, not closed as we close the eyes of human dead, stared disconcertingly up at the far-off golden canopy of the grove. One of them he took to be Hyoi, and it was certainly Hyoi's brother, Hiahi, who now came forward, and after an obeisance to Oyarsa, began to speak. Ransom at first did not hear what he was saying, for his attention was concentrated on Western and Divine. They were weaponless, and vigilantly guarded by the armed Hrossa about them. Both of them, like Ransom himself, had let their beards grow ever since they landed on Malacandra, and both were pale and travel-stained. Western was standing with folded arms, and his face wore a fixed, even an elaborate, expression of desperation. Divine, with his hands in his pockets, seemed to be in a state of furious sulks. Both clearly thought that they had good reason to fear, though neither was by any means lacking in courage. Surrounded by their guards, as they were, and intent on the scene before them, they had not noticed Ransom. He became aware of what Hyoi's brother was saying. "For the death of these two, Oyarsa, I do not so much complain, for when we fell upon the Hmana by night, they were in terror. You may say it was as a hunt, and these two were killed, as they might have been by a Hnakra. But Hyoi they hit from afar with a coward's weapon when he had done nothing to frighten them. And now he lies there, and I do not say it because he was my brother, but all the Handramit knows it, and he was a Hnakrapunt, and a great poet, and the loss of him is heavy." The voice of Oyarsa spoke for the first time to the two men. "Why have you killed my Hnau?" it said. Western and Divine looked anxiously about them to identify the speaker. "God!" exclaimed Divine in English. "Don't tell me they've got a loudspeaker." "Ventriloquism," replied Western in a husky whisper. "Quite common among savages. The witch doctor or medicine man pretends to go into a trance, and he does it. The thing to do is to identify the medicine man and address your remarks to him, wherever the voice seems to come from. It shatters his nerve and shows you've seen through him. Do you see any of the brutes in a trance?" "By Jove, I've spotted him." Due credit must be given to Western for his powers of observation. He had picked out the only creature in the assembly which was not standing in an attitude of reverence and attention. This was an elderly Hross close beside him. It was squatting, and its eyes were shut. Taking a step towards it, he struck a defiant attitude and exclaimed in a loud voice — his knowledge of the language was elementary — "Why you take our puff-bangs away? We very angry with you. We not afraid." On Western's hypothesis, his action ought to have been impressive. Unfortunately for him, no one else shared his theory of the elderly Hross's behavior. The Hross, who was well known to all of them, including Ransom, had not come with the funeral procession. It had been in its place since dawn. Doubtless it intended no disrespect to Oyarsa, but it must be confessed that it had yielded, at a much earlier stage of the proceedings, to an infirmity which attacks elderly now of all species, and was by this time enjoying a profound and refreshing slumber. One of its whiskers twitched a little as Weston shouted in its face, but its eyes remained shut. The voice of Oyarsa spoke again. "Why do you speak to him?" it said. "It is I who ask you. Why have you killed my Hnau?"
"You let us go, then we talky talky," bellowed Weston at the sleeping horse. "You think we no power, think you do all you like, you no can. Great big headman in sky, he send us. You no do what I say, he come, blow you all up. Poof, bang."
"I do not know what bang means," said the voice, "but why have you killed my Hnau?"
"Say it was an accident," muttered Divine to Weston in English.
"I've told you before," replied Weston in the same language, "you don't understand how to deal with natives. One sign of yielding and they'll be at our throats. The only thing is to intimidate them."
"All right, do your stuff then," growled Divine. He was obviously losing faith in his partner.
Weston cleared his throat and again rounded on the elderly Hross.
"We kill him," he shouted. "Show what we can do. Everyone who no do all we say, poof, bang, kill him, same as that one. You do all we say, and we give you much pretty things. See, see."
To Ransom's intense discomfort, Weston at this point whipped out of his pocket a brightly coloured necklace of beads, the undoubted work of Mr. Woolworth, and began dangling it in front of the faces of his guards, turning slowly round and round and repeating, "Pretty, pretty, see, see." The result of this manoeuvre was more striking than Weston himself had anticipated. Such a roar of sounds as human ears had never heard before. Baying of Hrossa, piping of Fiffletriggy, booming of Sorns, burst out and rent the silence of that august place, waking echoes from the distant mountain walls. Even in the air above them there was a faint ringing of the Eldil voices. It is greatly to Weston's credit that though he paled at this, he did not lose his nerve.
"You no roar at me," he thundered. "No try make me afraid. Me no afraid of you."
"You must forgive my people," said the voice of Oyarsa, and even it was subtly changed. "But they are not roaring at you. They are only laughing." But Weston did not know the Malachandrian word for laugh. Indeed, it was not a word he understood very well in any language. He looked about him with a puzzled expression. Ransom, biting his lips with mortification, almost prayed that one experiment with the beads would satisfy the scientist. But that was because he did not know Weston. The latter saw that the clamour had subsided. He knew that he was following the most orthodox rules for frightening and then conciliating primitive races. And he was not the man to be deterred by one or two failures. The roar that went up from the throats of all spectator of a humming-top, occasionally mopping his brow with his left hand and conscientiously jerking the necklace up and down with his right, completely drowned anything. But Ransom saw his lips moving, and had little doubt that he was working away at "pretty, pretty." Then suddenly the sound of laughter almost redoubled in volume. The stars in their courses were fighting against Weston. Some hazy memory of efforts made long since to entertain an infant niece had begun to penetrate his highly trained mind. He was bobbing up and down from the knees and holding his head on one side. He was almost dancing, and he was by now very hot indeed. For all Ransom knew, he was saying, "Diddle, diddle, diddle." It was sheer exhaustion which ended the great physicist's performance, the most successful of its kind ever given on Malachandra, and with it the sonorous raptures of his audience. As silence returned, Ransom heard Divine's voice in English. "For God's sake, stop making a buffoon of yourself, Weston," it said. "Can't you see it won't work?"
"It doesn't seem to be working," admitted Weston. "And I'm inclined to think they have even less intelligence than we supposed. Do you think perhaps if I tried it just once again? Or would you like to try it this time?"
"Oh, hell!" said Divine, and turning his back on his partner, sat down abruptly on the ground, produced his cigarette case, and began to smoke.
"I'll give it to the witch doctor," said Weston, during the moment of silence which Divine's action had produced among the mystified spectators. And before anyone could stop him, he took a step forward and attempted to drop the string of beads round the elderly Hross's neck. The Hross's head was, however, too large for this operation, and the necklace merely settled on its forehead like a crown, slightly over one eye. It shifted its head a little, like a dog worried with flies, snorted gently, and resumed its sleep. Oyarsa's voice now addressed Ransom. "Are your fellow creatures hurt in their brains, Ransom of Sulcandra?" it said. "Or are they too much afraid to answer my questions?"
"I think, Oyarsa," said Ransom, "that they do not believe you are there. And they believe that all these now are like very young cubs. The thicker man is trying to frighten them, and then to please them with gifts."
At the sound of Ransom's voice, the two prisoners turned sharply around. Weston was about to speak when Ransom interrupted him hastily in English.
"Listen, Weston, it is not a trick. There really is a creature there in the middle, there where you can see a kind of light, or a kind of something, if you look hard. And it is at least as intelligent as a man. They seem to live an enormous time. Stop treating it like a child and answer its questions. And if you take my advice, you'll speak the truth and not bluster."
"The brute seemed to have intelligence enough to take you in anyway," growled Weston.
But it was in a somewhat modified voice that he turned once more to the sleeping Hross. The desire to wake up the supposed witch-doctor was becoming an obsession, and addressed it.
"We sorry we kill him," he said, pointing to Hyoi. "No go to kill him. Sorns tell us bring man, give him your big head. We go away back into sky. He come," here he indicated Ransom, "with us. He very bent man, run away, no do what Sorns say, like us. We run after him, get him back for Sorns. Want to do what we say, and Sorns tell us, see? He not let us. Run away, run, run. We run after. See big black one, think he kill us. We kill him, poof, bang. All for bent man. He no run away, he be good, we no run after. No kill big black one, see? You have bent man. Bent man make all trouble. You plenty keep him, let us go. He afraid of you, we no afraid. Listen."
At this moment, Weston's continual bellowing in the face of the Hross at last produced the effect he had striven for so long. The creature opened its eyes and stared mildly at him in some perplexity. Then, gradually realizing the impropriety of which it had been guilty, it rose slowly to its standing position, bowed respectfully to Oyarsa, and finally waddled out of the assembly, still carrying the necklace draped over its right ear and eye. Weston, his mouth still open, followed the retreating figure with his gaze till it vanished among the stems of the grove. It was Oyarsa who broke the silence. "We have had mirth enough," he said, "and it is time to hear true answers to our questions. Something is wrong in your head now from Sulcandra. There is too much blood in it. Is Firikitakile here?"
"Here, Oyarsa," said a Fiffletrig.
"Have you in your cisterns water that has been made cold?"
"Yes, Oyarsa."
"Then let this thick now be taken to the guest house, and let them bathe his head in cold water. Much water, and many times. Then bring him again. Meanwhile I will provide for my killed Hrossa." Weston did not clearly understand what the voice said. Indeed, he was still too busy trying to find out where it came from. But terror smote him as he found himself wrapped in the strong arms of the surrounding Hrossa and forced away from his place. Ransom would gladly have shouted out some reassurance, but Weston himself was shouting too loud to hear him. He was mixing English and Malacandrian now, and the last that was heard was a rising scream of, "Pay for this! Poof! Bang! Ransom! For God's sake! Ransom! Ransom!" "And now," said Oyarsa, when silence was restored, "let us honour my dead now." At his words, 10 of the Hrossa grouped themselves about the biers. Lifting their heads, and with no signal given as far as Ransom could see, they began to sing. To every man, in his acquaintance with a new art, there comes a moment when that which before was meaningless first lifts, as it were, one corner of the curtain that hides its mystery, and reveals, in a burst of delight which later and fuller understanding can hardly ever equal, one glimpse of the indefinite possibilities within. For Ransom, this moment had now come in his understanding of Malacandrian song. Now first he saw that its rhythms were based on a different blood from ours, on a heart that beat more quickly, and a fiercer internal heat. Through his knowledge of the creatures and his love for them, he began, ever so little, to hear it with their ears. A sense of great masses moving at visionary speeds, of giants dancing, of eternal sorrows eternally consoled, of he knew not what, and yet what he had always known, awoke in him with the very first bars of the deep-mouthed dirge, and bowed down his spirit as if the gate of heaven had opened before him.
Let it go hence, they sang. Let it go hence, dissolve and be no body. Drop it, release it, drop it gently, as a stone is loosed from the fingers drooping over a still pool. Let it go down, sink, fall away. Once below the surface there are no divisions, no layers in the water yielding all the way down. All one and all unwounded is that element. Send it voyaging where it will not come again. Let it go down. The now rises from it. This is the second life, the other beginning. Open, O coloured world, without weight, without shore. You are second and better. This was first and feeble. Once the worlds were hot within and brought forth life, but only the pale plants, the dark plants. We see their children when they grow today, out of the sun's light, in the sad places. After, the heaven made grow another kind on worlds, the high climbers, the bright-haired forests, cheeks of flowers. First were the darker, then the brighter. First was the world's blood, then the sun's brood. This was as much of it as he contrived later to remember and could translate. As the song ended, Oyarsa said, Let us scatter the movements which were their bodies. So will Maleldil scatter all worlds when the first and feeble is worn. He made a sign to one of the Fifeltrigi, who instantly arose and approached the corpses. The Hrossa, now singing again, but very softly, drew back at least 10 paces. The Fifeltrig touched each of the 3 dead in turn with some small object that appeared to be made of glass or crystal, and then jumped away with one of his frog-like leaps. Ransom closed his eyes to protect them from a blinding light, and felt something like a very strong wind blowing in his face, for a fraction of a second. Then all was calm again, and the 3 biers were empty.
"God, that would be a trick worth knowing on Earth," said Divine to Ransom. "Solves the murderer's problem about the disposal of the body, eh?"
But Ransom, who was thinking of Hyoi, did not answer him. And before he spoke again, everyone's attention was diverted by the return of the unhappy Western among his guards.